Welcome to Side by Side, a podcast where I, Robert Kwong, take you inside conversations with artists, creatives, healers, and warriors taking the charge in their transformational story. Today's guest is Yvonne Edebiri, a creative producer, theater maker, and the director of artistic programs at the Signature Theater. Before audio and podcast plays became popular due to social distancing, Yvonne had been at the forefront of this medium as the founder of The Parsnip Ship, a theater company and platform that reimagines the radio play through stories that differ in form, content, and plot by underproduced and underrepresented voices. In this conversation, we talk about the changing landscape of the theater industry, finding balance between your profession and your personhood, and the need to acknowledge theater makers who work tirelessly behind the curtains and out of the spotlight. Oh my goodness. Well, okay, so you and I have known each other for quite a while.
Yeah.
And you know what's funny? I was prepping for our conversation and I listened to an interview I did with you way back when for this other project I did interviewing people. It was about self-care and taking care of yourself. And that was in February of 2016, before the election. I mean, a whole other like universe.
Yeah, wow.
And then since then, we haven't caught up since really like right before the pandemic started. So I'll start with a general conversation starter. How have you been? How's life since 2020?
Life is so fast. Everything is fast. Everything is going by. Time is blurring. Busy. The busiest I've ever been, and have settled into this busyness that feels very like very weird, but I guess it's my new normal. And kind of, I think, well, I will say over the last 3 years specifically, I think that 25-year-old Yvonne would be very proud. Yvonne of 10 years ago, Yvonne of, you know, person who graduated Brandeis in 2013 would be very proud of where she is right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also that Yvonne of 10 years ago, if she saw even what the day-to-day is, a day like today where I'm working from home, yet it ends up being like a 12-plus-hour day. No matter how much I try to avoid having that happen, it happens. I think she would be like, yo, like, are you good?
All that Yvonne's like, are you good?
Like, I'm proud of you, but like, are we going to clubs? And I'm like, no, we don't do that. We're really tired. We watch The Golden Girls in the morning. Okay, 22-year-old Yvonne, that is how we live. Yeah.
You're speaking my language. I think people would be surprised, or listeners would be surprised, that you work in the performing arts. You work in theater, live theater, often, predominantly. But you told me something that I was even shocked by, which is that, you know, as the pandemic hit our world, your work didn't necessarily slow down despite you working in the performing arts. In fact, you said there were times where it spiked. It was more intensive. And a lot of people during the pandemic, they were like taking gaps, taking pauses, and making transitions. And that really wasn't your experience for the past few years. I mean, what has it been like working in theater during the past few years?
It's hard. It is really, really hard. I think there's some moments when it feels easier, but with COVID now as this new becoming, I will say, this new normal of disruption, and how I hope we factor in the fact that that can always be a thing that happens. And it feels like we always need to make backup plans, and everyone's tired of making backup plans, and making backup plans is expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it feels fruitless. Sometimes that feels daunting. And I think that all just feels overwhelming when you're trying to put something together and also care for people and also try to put money in people's pocket and also try to care for yourself and also try to make sure that you're not losing money or not losing a lot of money. I think there are so many factors when you're not in this world necessarily of like commercial theater per se. There's so many if, ands, or buts that yeah. really affect us on a really large scale. Like one person test positive for COVID is like, you know, that could be yeah. the beginning of productions closing early. That yeah. means someone doesn't make, you know, certain things for their pension and their healthcare. And so I think people who aren't in this industry find some of the, you know, COVID procedures that we take, like masking and, you know, no stage door, blah, blah, blah. Some of these things we need to implement as radical, but they're really just self-preservation. And I think our industry is actually now starting to feel the effects of COVID. I think like the first year was like a, I don't want to say a fluke year. I think it was an experimental year. People learned a lot. I think, you know, we had government support at least at the time, but that's all going away. And I think we're ending back up in this financial predicament that a lot of nonprofit theaters particularly have always been at. And now it's exacerbated by COVID and low staff. And people just being frankly just really fucking tired. People are tired. People are exhausted. And I think people want love that their jobs are back. And yeah, that's great. But me, I will say I am tired. I would love just time to sleep and not labor for a bit. And I did not get that. And I'm grateful that I was busy during the pandemic because a lot of people wish that they could be and they weren't. And so I'm very grateful for that and the opportunities provided, but I would also love the opportunity of rest because that also feels like another radical step that our industry really needs to remember to take at times. You know?
Right. When we're no longer just worried about how do we get off life support, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We're just, you know, I think people are just trying to take it day by day. And hopefully one day we'll make it to a place where we can take it month by month and really begin to space ourselves out. Yeah. And there are many ways we can maybe get there. I don't know if we will. I hope we will. I'd like to be positive. But I think a part of it, a lot of it, it comes down to like the different ways we need to feed ourselves outside of the performing arts.
And that's something we've spoken about quite a bit in our private conversations and over the years. And I have this quote that's from the old interview when we were talking about self-care for writers, creatives, multifaceted people, which obviously you are. This is your description of being a writer slash composer or creative. Based on the writers and composers I've met, I would say there is an anxiety that manifests in different ways. You don't sleep well. You don't exercise. You shut yourself in your room when maybe you just need to take a walk. There's always that feeling of having to go through 30 million tabs in your head before you find what you need. There's also the obsession with perfectionism that creates this big ball of anxiety. I think creative people in general just need to figure out this balance. When I read that and when I heard that, I was like, boy, no lies were told that day, huh, for you.
Wow, that's so funny hearing that because I'm like, ah, I didn't realize like, oh, those are all the symptoms of ADHD, which I got diagnosed with not too long after that. And I was like, it all kind of just like made sense of like why I was feeling that way. But I also still think it's incredibly, it's still very true.
Well, and getting a late diagnosis also, I think, has like a different way of how you process it because it's not something that you've just known since you were in elementary school or something like that. And I know for a lot of people that has being seen in certain ways, culturally speaking, and you're a Nigerian immigrant where being excellent and being a high performer is really an asset. It's really seen as a positive. Mm-hmm. And that's really been evident in your life. So how do you find balance from being someone who's perfectly capable of being a high performer, being a producer of all these different projects, And then at the same time, it's like balancing that out with recharging you, which is the person who's making all this, all these amazing projects possible. You know, where are you at now, especially over the past few years where you have this diagnosis and also grappling with work and also what was happening around the world?
Yeah, I think I've just started to lean into doing less and being okay with that and doing my best and being okay with that. I do sometimes fall into, oh God, this isn't perfect, but I also realize that I can't control everything. And sometimes just reminding myself, well, you can't control this thing. You can't control other people's behavior. You can't control X, Y, and Z. I can control my feelings and I can control like how I respond to this. And I think just always getting back to that has been super helpful. And part of that is realizing that, man, like during the pandemic, my social battery really changed. I feel like I used to be such an extrovert and I needed to be out and about. And I was out and about these 10, 11, 12 hours in the theater, talking with people, doing my thing.
Oh, yeah.
That felt great, like going out to go see as many shows as possible. And no, I, I am in a space where for the most part, I don't go see shows on the weekends. It's like I sometimes, you know, we'll do it on a case by case basis / if I'm getting paid to go to see a theater show. Great. That's awesome. Or if anyone wants to sponsor me to see Six, the musical every Saturday, I will leave my house for that. But for the most part, I don't, because I work, like I fortunately work in a place where I have a hybrid schedule and I can work from home and work and go into an office 3 times a week. I go into the city in the office, and that's when I go see shows, and I try to see as many shows there if I am in that mood and space and spirit. I've also just learned to hone into what my spirit says. And I'll go like, my spirit just says, don't go see a 2.5 hour show where you know you're going to be annoyed. But for what reason?
Right.
I think like just being okay with going like, I don't need to see everything or do everything. Like I have plenty on my plate. I'm building different things at different times. And that takes time, that takes energy and focus and emotional energy and extrovert energy. I find I love doing what I call antisocial Saturdays, where the only thing I do usually is I go work out at the gym in the morning, and the rest of the day I just stay home and I watch reruns of Law and Order SVU or some other show where I can just be mindless or be as many tabs, open up as many tabs in my head as I want to, but just that's my time for me to like really just reconnect with myself and recharge however I see fit. And usually it means that I don't want to talk with people.
Right.
I just need to talk with myself sometimes and process, or just sit in silence or just play some music and not have a time limit on when that ends or me needing to move on to the next thing. And so that has been my saving grace. And also just like part of that is just boundary setting, as much boundary setting as I can muster.
Yeah.
So that I don't wear myself out, because it feels like at this point, a lot of us working in this industry are always approaching incredible burnouts. It's just about how do we stave it off, right? So that we can continue to show up and be our best selves despite the circumstances and the odds. And for me, I'm like, y'all, for me to be, you know, optimistic and bubbly Yvonne, I just really cannot talk to any fucking person for like at least 8 hours on a Saturday or a Sunday. Like, please give me that and I will be fun. I'll be through.
That is a neurospicy person reclaiming their power. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. But please do not engage conversation with me. Don't ask me a question unless it's something where it's enforcing, like needing to not think about work. I think for the most part, that antisocial Saturday is for me to not think about theater.
Right.
And that's why for me, not seeing shows on the weekends, that's a huge boundary I have to put up so that I'm compartmentalizing my job versus who I am as a person, because I am right. not theater. Like right. my job is not me.
Yeah.
And I also don't want to lead people into thinking that that is how I operate my life. And that is how I want to operate my life. And that's what brings me joy.
Right.
My career is not the center of my, of who I am and what will bring me, like what brings me happiness. It's really my relationships. And part of not doing theater related stuff on the weekend as much as possible is to reconnect with relationships and to reconnect with myself, because that's how I'll recharge and be able to come back on Monday and go, I'm here, I'm present.
And to keep the spirit of why you fell in love with this world in the first exactly. place alive, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. I want to love theater. Sometimes I don't like it. You know, right. it's hard over the last since the pandemic to like go like, wow, I really like what I'm doing, when it's really like, I love what I'm doing, but damn, this is really hard that it's this difficult to do it.
Right.
And that gets really tiring to do when you never know when the rug could be pulled from under you.
Well, and I always think about this, especially in this month that we're in. You've talked about this before in our previous conversations, where it's like, there are also times where you have to set a boundary with having to be the spokesperson as like yep. the trailblazer, as a Black woman, as an excellent Black woman, being excellent in this world and this in this industry. And you kind of said there are times where it's like, in order for me to live my mission, live according to my beliefs around this stuff, like racial equity, I can't just be pegged as a spokesperson, as the one with solutions all the time. And I don't know, I assume that's still the case for you, where you still have to set that boundary. But how do you grapple with that these days, you know?
I think, like, for the most part, people know I'm not gonna necessarily be like a spokesperson in that regard. Like, I just don't see that as like a space I want to occupy. I do think actions speak louder than words.
Right.
In the end. And so a theater company can say we're doing X, Y, and Z this, and then they're actually doing, you know, a whole nother thing. I don't think it's always up to or fair to ask, you know, Black people or people of color to be that person, when just about 2-3 years ago, white people were all trying to be down for the cause. So, but you know, now that it's not like this super in your face thing, despite the continuous murders of Black people and brown people in the hands of law enforcement since 2020, since 2021, since 2022, and now we're in 2023, and there's already been another one. Like, you know, I think we see where people actually lie, and I do too. I clock it and I'm aware and I see it. For me, it's good to know, and I move accordingly, but I don't plan to be the spokesperson for, I guess, an organization outside of the one of my own, in which my beliefs are my beliefs, but also the mission and the values of organizations can really tell you what they are actually about, and how
right.
they use the money that's donated to them, how they move through the world, how they connect artists.
Right.
I think not enough people are as aware as I think they should be. They're mostly looking on the artist front rather than the administrative front as well.
Hmm. You mean in terms of seeing change and seeing progression?
Seeing change, seeing progression, measuring progress, and right. actually holding organizations accountable. I think people tend to look at the artist lens because that feels the most forward facing and the most exciting and the most visible thing to talk about. But behind every theater institution are dozens, sometimes up to hundreds of people whose work go into supporting every piece of the machine that makes those artists be able to get out on the stage to entertain two audiences who are paying money to be entertained. And so there's this disconnect between audiences and like the admins, right? And no one ever really talks about that as much. We tend to be focused on the artists and the artist needs, which again are fair. But, you know, there are people in the and admin staff that are being underpaid and overworked even more than actors who at least have a union for the most part to support them.
Right.
But administrators do not.
It's so funny you say that because I always thought that's one of the big misconceptions about working in theater is that so much mm-hmm. of the labor and so much of the magic comes from people you'll never see. Whose names you'll never remember.
Correct.
And a lot of times I'm in rooms and in group collaborations where I'm always like, man, you know, we need someone who's really skilled in something closer to like a really good like producer or a really good stage manager. It's someone who is working with a lot of other people, but being mm-hmm. really powerful in that position. And I was always like, man, I wish more people had like competency in knowing how to be that type of collaborator. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's so undervalued.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that are undervalued in our industry that need to be valued more. Like looking at that article about the company manager on Anne Juliet that's been going around and you know, she's talking about how she works 11, 12 hour days, 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days. And I'm like, yes, I remember this life. I too live this life of a company manager. And I get what she was saying in the article about it's great if you love it and it's kind of crazy. You work all these hours. And I do love company managing and I sometimes do miss it, but I do not miss the low pay and the long hours.
Right.
And I used to just get really fucking annoyed that I would be there like working 60, 70 hours a week, you know, taking care of like the whims and needs and whatever of artists and crews and company and folks who made, you know, several times as much as me and also had benefits and also got these perks. Literally just worked 10 to 6 p.m. And it felt so much like the pyramid was so inverted. And like, what are we here for? And I don't think artists, I just wished artists, particularly actors, to really, you know, acknowledge and support that kind of support and resource that's given to them to be valued a little bit more because it really deserves to be.
Yeah. And you kind of get to have that space to own that mission with something like the Parsnipship. And it's so funny talking to you now because a few years ago, even pod plays or audio theater or anything like that, or radio plays, it was not so normalized as it is now. But then since, because of the last few years, things have developed a bit and people are finding ways to transition more online, more virtual. Of course, doing audio work the way that you've been doing for the past few years, you were kind of one of the front runners in establishing this type of work. What is the kind of future you wish for theater makers and for a place like Parsnipship for you personally?
Good question. I think for Parsnip, I wanted to continue to grow in the amount of stories that are told on the platform. And continuing to grow up until a certain size as an organization. I hesitate with any organization that's too big. I think sometimes that gets into like, it gets more into the business of it rather than like the art of it, which is in the end, like why we're all there. And so I think that there's some level of it needing to still stay small. And I don't want to say contained. I want Parsnip to, as an organization, to still feel like a family in a way, and not like weird, like fucked up way. Yeah. We're like a family here, and they're all like really shitty to each other. I want like people can still reach out and ask for help or questions, and that they have met other people through the platform and the space and the community that we're providing, and that they feel like they can always return to that,
right,
and not feel intimidated by it because we got too big. Like, I don't want it to ever feel like that. Lose its heart, I feel.
Right.
And then for theater, I don't know. I don't know about the future for theater. I think I change my mind on it every day. And right now I'm landing on the next 2-3 years will be very telling. I think the financial fallout from COVID and where we're at now will be felt over the next like year and a half, 2 years, particularly. And so I think that it's just going to be a really rough go for our industry for the next 3 years. I am trying to just be mentally prepared for that. Also just be optimistic that what we will find out from all of this is, I would hope that a lot of the phoenixes rise from the ashes, and that the gems, the diamonds are the ones that really stick out at the end. I sense that coming. I say that because I sense that from like the situation with the Met, for example, in which they are, you know, going into their pocket of reserve and their endowment to supplement the money that they know it's going to cost to commission new operas, because they tried out when they came back, they had a great opera. What is it called? Fire Shut Up in My Bones. I thought that was incredible. And I saw a couple of other things, I think, including Porgy and Bess, because I was like, well, if I'm going to go to the Met, like, I might as well see all the things with, you know, Black people. And Fire Shut Up in My Bones, it was just a regular Tuesday. And man, Black people showed up dressed to the nines. Like, it was a fucking like red carpet. It made no sense. I kept asking, like, why are you dressed up? And they were like, because baby, be coming to the Met. And I'm just like, well, damn right. And just seeing that was just so great. So then I bought a ticket to see Porgy and Bess. And it was like, ah, this is a terrible opera. Holy fuck, the Gershwins were racist as fuck. No, I don't want to do this again. So seeing that the audiences have it, that like all the new shit that we're doing is outselling by far all of these classics that they really reprogram every like 2-3 years. I see like a new like magic flute, and I'm like, how many times can y'all do this show? Like, and so to see the fact that they're like, okay, fuck, we need to dip into our money in order to know that like in the long run, this is going to make us money because it is bringing in new audiences, tried and true, is great. And if I say this because if a storied institution, mega institution like the Met could make such a decision like that, radically, because they know in the end, bottom line, money is money and capitalism is capitalism, and they know it's a strategic move, and it's also a great creative and artistic move. Like, I'm really excited to go to see more what the Met has in store, knowing that they have made this radical shift to go, we're not going to say no, we're not doing these classics, but they're not going to take up most of our season anymore, because the writing is on the wall and it's evident that like, this is not what our audiences want. And we also have lost a lot of the older audiences who wanted this other shit anyway. And I think a lot of theater companies are starting to regress to not what the Met is doing. They're going back to doing their tried and true. It's like, I want more places to do what the Met is doing. Just be a little bit more radical. Like, the audiences are there. Like, I think a lot of us now don't want to spend money to see shows if we know it's the same old, same old. I think we're okay with like maybe the guarantee that the thing might not be great. But as long as it's like exciting, we just like people are more conscientious about where they want to spend their money and their time. Like, I've stopped seeing most shows as well, because after 2.5 hours, I'm like, if you haven't made me cry, laugh, and like feel anything, and I just sat here for 3 motherfucking hours and the train is running local, I'm mad. I am mad. And y'all got me fucked up. That's why I had to stop, because I was like, I'm mad. Y'all are giving mediocrity at a premium, and you want me to be one of your new audiences, and I'm mad. I won't be purchasing a ticket here anymore.
I mean, it's sort of like seeing how different companies, like, do they want business as usual? Which is sometimes for artistic organizations, they're still like, yeah. Oh, it's business as usual. But yeah, that's not been our reality for the past 3 years. And guess who might have something to say about it? Creatives, the people who are actually in charge of creating these things. And
audiences. Like, I think people just are demanding better. And I think our industry just cannot take another Sondheim revival. I will say that I do not get it. And I see all these Sondheim revivals, and I have conversations with people, just dramaturgically speaking, Sondheim is not great. And I poke holes in why these are not good musicals, or just stories, separate from the music. And people are like, yeah, I know, but it's such a classic. I'm like, but you can't really say what you love about it. You can't really talk about why you emotionally connect to it now. Now, if you're doing this out of nostalgia, say that. But don't gaslight yourself into thinking that this is actually a viable, good work of art for our modern times. I'm sorry, you cannot make company female,
right,
and gender swap and think it holds up to 2022. And until we acknowledge the chokehold that certain creatives and certain producers and gatekeepers just really have on this industry, it's just not going to change. And part of that are like the relationships to foundations. Corporations help run American theater, and we don't talk about that. Tinder, OkCupid, Match.com, all of that helps fund theater and theater productions in New York City. So yeah, every time y'all like Match, hey, thank you for supporting the arts in New York City.
Which is really the biggest takeaway of this conversation. Support like, Match.com.
Right. Like the person who owns Match.com also does run his own arts nonprofit, and also has given to a lot of capital campaigns in New York City. And so like, there's a lot of like our money and the way we use these apps and blah, blah, blah are all tied to the people, the gatekeepers, and they're who decides this culture. But really it's us in the end. Like, they need our money. They need our information to figure out what we want and what they can sell us.
And they need us to care.
And they need us to care. And right now, a lot of us are just like checking out from caring, on top of the fact that eggs are like $20.
Right. So
the priorities are different.
Oh, okay. Thank you for that sermon, really. I mean, preach. And I guess I want to leave us, because I know your time is precious, leave us on a positive note. What are some things you want to envision for yourself for the next few years? Just you personally, Ivan.
Oh, rest, manifesting a lot of beach time and sun, manifesting better, me watching like the best productions that really cement why I do theater. Because the more I see shows that move me, in any way, shape, or form, the more I'm reminded about why I do this despite the fuckery. And it's nice to have that reminder. And I'm also manifesting or envisioning a life where theater is something that I do. It is definitely a part of how I see the world, but it is not my entire world.
Right. Yes, we want this for Ivan. And thank you for taking time out for, like, I don't know, just unpacking some of this stuff. And it's going to be great. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. This was awesome. Thanks so much, Robert.
Thank you for tuning in. If you'd like to connect with me about the podcast or about my services, you can find me on Instagram at Robert Kwong Home, or you can find me through my coaching website at www.robertkwongcoaching.com.